Good morning, science. My name is Alexandra Magald, and today I'm talking to Professor Tejveer Khurana from UPenn. During his PhD at the Kanka Lab at Harvard, he discovered utrophin. Utrophin is a homolog of dystrophin, the protein that, if mutated, causes Duchenne muscular dystrophy, a genetic disease that destroys muscle and often kills its victims in their teens. In his lab, Professor Khurana has done groundbreaking research on the utrophin ecosystem and of its regulation. Tejveer is using small molecules to have it replace the broken protein. He aims to cure or significantly extend the lives of his Duchenne patients. His work is world-renowned, and so it's not exactly surprising that his lab has and is being funded by grants worldwide, and he has been awarded many honors, such as the Presidential Early Career Award for Scientists and Engineers, which is the highest of its kind from the White House. He is also an avid climber and has done hypoxia research with expeditions to the Earth's highest mountains. Professor Khurana, what's your favorite part of research?
Well, actually, Bella, what I like is the whole research enterprise, you know, from having a problem, defining it, asking the right problems about how you're going to solve this. You talk to your colleagues, you talk to friends, you talk to students, you read up on it. And then many times the tools that you require to really ask the question in a better way aren't available. So you're jerry-rigging it. We're physiologists, we build stuff. And, you know, if needed, you build it. You ask the question, get the information, and, you know, look over the, discuss the information that you get. And finally, you disseminate the information either via a meeting or publications. And that's what I like about the whole process. It's you know, very satisfying when it works.
When do you really feel in your element?
Well, again, you know, it's the whole process to say, but I would say that the part I like the most personally is when you find that the tools that you need are not available. And then you've got to think a bit creatively and kind of figure them out. Some may or may not have been, they may be an off-the-cuff solution, they may not. And I particularly like it when you can jerry-rig something and make it on the cheap. It's, you know, kind of repurposed stuff to answer a problem. So I always like giving this example. When my lab was first starting out, we needed to measure muscle force. And it was somewhat complicated because you had to also stretch the muscle at the same time. And there are, you know, hundreds of ways of doing it precisely. But we ended up using a step motor solution. And the best part of it was the step motor was ripped out of a disk drive, if people even remember floppy disks.
Oh my God.
It worked very well, and it worked very precisely to a 2.5 micron resolution.
You've done so many things. Is there a favorite project in the past or in the future that you have?
Well, again, you know, there are many different things I like about different projects. So I won't say there's one versus the other. But again, from a personal point of view, the ones with the greatest challenges are the one you remember the most. So as you know, I have an interest in muscle performance, muscle diseases, and especially muscular dystrophy. And one of the things which is problematic and big problem for muscular dystrophy is people die of respiratory problems. So we're all very aware with COVID and so forth, suddenly about the importance of respiration. So the question is, how bad is hypoxia or lack of oxygen for your muscles? Now, you could, again, do this many ways, but one of the ways to do it, which is actually a real world experience, is to use terrestrial elevations or mountains to take an animal subject up and study the effects of it and humans. So we did these experiments on Denali, where we had a model system, the Drosophila, which was modeled with a mutation for muscular dystrophy. And we wanted to ask the question, how bad is hypoxia for it? Now, obviously, you can't do this in humans, and you shouldn't do this experiment in humans, but you can do it in an animal study. So it was very nice that we managed to successfully carry what are fundamentally cold-blooded animals up in a very cold and harsh environment, which is also hypoxic. And we got very good data out of it. So, you know, developing the methods to carry them up, carrying it out, bringing them down along with my colleague, Gabrielle Willman, was really very satisfying, both from a scientific and a personal point of view.
Yeah, I bet. Wow, what a way to do research. So if you had absolutely no limitations in terms of finances, workforce, anything, what would be your dream thing to do? What would you love to do?
Yeah, I mean, again, from a basic point of view and from a translational point of view, my lab works on both. And from a translational point of view, we, you know, now that we've been in the field for many years and the questions are more defined, we've got molecules identified that in principle should be tested in humans. And I think if all resources were available and everything was available, that's what I'd really like to address is, can these actually help a patient with muscular dystrophy?
Okay, so asking this the other way around, what do you see as the biggest problem to progress in your field?
Yeah, so in my field, I think the biggest hindrance right now is a lack of financial support to take molecules into humans. These are extremely expensive experiments. And as a basic scientist, your entire career's funding would not be sufficient to even test one molecule in clinical trials. And so one way to go around that is to actually spin off a startup, which we've done at Penn, and it's called MyoRed, with the single purpose of taking these molecules we've discovered in the lab with obviously with federal and foundation support like the Muscular Dystrophy Association and NIH, and actually take those into humans. And I think that is the real crux of the problem.
Wow, nice. So if there are any investors listening, we'll absolutely link out to the startup, and I cannot wait to see what they come up with in the future. Talking about the future, one question that I really love to ask is, if you were to have a time machine and if you'd come back 200 or 1,000 years from now, what would you love to know? What would you look up first?
Well, I mean, first, given the planet we live in, I'd like to know if human life is still on the planet. And
let's assume it is. Let's just be optimistic and assume we're still here.
Assuming we're still here, I certainly would like to see if any of the data developed, I mean, from a personal point of view, any of the research we did towards these molecules, for example, have actually contributed in a positive way towards humans. I think positively, and I'd like to think the planet would be in a better place, and you know, humankind would be in a better place, and it would be nice to see it. You know, that's pretty much the. I think every scientist would like to see where the stuff they've done in their careers. Whether it actually turned out to be true or not.
Thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks so much, Bella.